Well, good afternoon, everyone. Greetings to all of you on the webcast. I'm glad that you're joining us. It's nice to be able to have that. I was telling somebody last night, I have a love-hate relationship with two things, automobiles and technology. When it works, I love it. When it doesn't work, it creates headaches. But it's amazing we have things going on like a webcast that offers tremendous opportunity. And then when that music, you just can't get it going. And beautiful job on the singing. And it was just beautiful words and a nice song. I never heard that song before, but it had so much to think about. Thank you. Thank you very much. I saw on Facebook today that it's Paul Carter's birthday. Is that right? Yeah, I think it is. In light of Mr. Pennelly's presentation, I thought I should say something encouraging. Be a Barnabas to him. And I thought and thought and came up with something I heard a long time ago. They say the first 100 years are the hardest. So I hope that helps. As another year rolls by, congratulations. Also bring you greetings from the office. Mr. Franks and everybody there said to say hello. I think several have been out here. We try to send somebody out every year, I believe. So everybody who's been here says hi, and even some of those who haven't been here say hi. And a few months ago, a couple of months ago, Mr. Horchek asked if we could come out. We said, well, that would be great. We usually go to Louisville. Started looking at the calendar. I think it's been about 7 years since we've been here. Last time for a young adult leadership weekend right after we started here. So it's been a long time, and we're appreciative of the opportunity. It is a totally different experience than Louisville, where you have about 1,000 people. But, you know, it's like Mr. Armstrong used to say about the college campuses. People say, which campus do you like best? Well, how do you answer that? And he always said, they mutually excel each other. And there are benefits of being with a huge group of people, and there are benefits of being with 40, 45 people. One is the intimacy here. You just get to sit down and talk with people in ways that, you know, after you go to Louisville, almost every year my wife and I would say, well, did you see so-and-so? Yeah, I saw him across the hall, you know. Didn't really get to sit down and talk with them. And that's something that you miss there a lot. So we're just really grateful to be here. And I've had a wonderful time so far and looking forward to the rest of it. I'd like to open with a question that I've had fun with over the years, primarily at summer camps with teenagers. Kimberly, you may remember this question from times past. And I will ask it the way I always ask teenagers. This is not a youth weekend. But all of you were youth at one time. You can all probably remember. If you're past those teenage years, you can remember what it was like being in high school. So you can answer this question, too, from your perspective. But here's the question. If Jesus had not been born 2,000 years ago, but had been born 16 years ago, and lived in your community, went to your high school, would the kids in your school like him? Would the kids like him? Now, we have no history about his teen years in the Bible. Nothing to indicate that he stood out with exceptional good looks or a lot of money or family status or power or position. So whatever your answer is, you have to draw your answer from other hints in the Bible. Or maybe you'll just speculate based on your own perspective of life, or maybe you will put some thought together and say, well, I'm going to reason this because of that, whatever it may be. We're told that at age 12, his parents let him travel with some others. That's what they thought he was doing. They found out later he had stayed back and was visiting in the temple, talking with the teachers and asking questions. And at that time, at age 12, already understood that he had a special calling to be about his father's business. But still, he had to live an everyday life. He grew up in a family, in a community. He had relatives. Did he have friends? Did he have acquaintances that he mixed with? How would he dress? What music would he listen to? What would he do after school? Would he go down to the park and shoot hoops with a bunch of the other kids? One year at camp, I remember a camper saying, no, he wouldn't do that. I said, what do you think he did? And he said, he went to his room and read his Bible. It's probably what he did every day after school. Holed up in his room and studied the Torah. I said, well, really? Why do you think that? Why do you think that's what he did? Well, he didn't explain it. That's just what he thought. If he was in your high school today, would he run like cross country on the track team in the spring? Would he be involved in school sports? You might say, boy, I'd like to have him on my cross country team. I mean, look, if he's 100 yards behind at the finish, he just does a miracle and zoom, you know, he can win every race. Is that the way he would do it? Would he be limited physically? Could some people outrun him? Would he make straight A's in school? I say, well, yeah, he knows everything. Doesn't have to study. Probably skip school, show up for the test, and ace everything. Is that the way he was? What would it be like? What if he came to church with you here at 16? Would he hang out with all the kids after church on Saturday night? Would he go get a burger and go to a movie? Would Jesus have done that sort of thing? What would he have been like at summer camp? Would he have gone to summer camp? Or would he have been above that? What would he do? What would he have been like at 16 if he was among all of us here? What would everybody think about him? Or would he have been so perfect that every mother on the street would be saying, why can't you be more like Jesus? Because he's perfect, Ma. You know, I can't be like Jesus. What would he have been like? I mean, what was life like? If he lived in your community and went to your school or attended in this congregation, would you like him? Would you like being around him every day? I want to ask for a show of hands. I've done this enough to know what the response is going to be. Some hands would say yes, some would say no, and some would say, I don't know. I'm still thinking about it. I have an opinion. I'll tell you later, as you might suspect, I will. But I like to think that the answer to the question about Jesus being liked, or what makes anybody be liked, that makes you want to be around somebody, or that makes somebody want to be around you, actually boils down to one word. It's a powerful word. It's a much misunderstood word. It's a word that a lot of people find hard to use correctly. Sometimes people are even embarrassed to use it. I have talked with people who have said, I never heard my parents use that word toward each other or toward their children. It's a sad thing. Yet it's a word that everybody talks about. It's a subject that's on everybody's mind. I bet we can't go a day without hearing it expressed in some way or another. It's a word that we all need to be expressed in different ways, in different contexts. You see a lot of people, children, teens, adults, who really need what this word describes, and they're just not getting enough. One of those different contexts, for example, for me personally, dealt with my relationship with females. I made my mind up when I was a teenager, late teenager. I made a promise to myself that I would use this word seriously to another female, or to a female, only if I was confident that they would say it back to me. I felt it was that important of a word. I didn't take it lightly, but it is often used lightly. It's a word that can be used carelessly. I have cringed before when I've heard it misused, when I've seen people use it to manipulate the emotions of other people to get what they want. It can be used that way. It's a word that describes the key thing that bridges the gaps in all relationships. Age gaps, cultural gaps, racial gaps, ethnic gaps. This is the thing that can bridge those gaps. And it is a word that the people of God must center on, strive to understand, and implement. And you know what word I'm talking about. I won't ask if you know it, because it's not much of a mystery given the theme of this weekend. It's a word that's used 500 times in the Bible. 500 times. 264 times in the Old Testament, 236 times in the New Testament. You think the New Testament, given the comparative size of the New Testament to the Old, and it uses that word almost as much as the Old Testament, there is a heavy emphasis in the New Testament and God's Word. Why is that? Because the Bible says this word, just that word, is a summary of God Himself. It says this word is a summary of His way of life, of His law. We find in the Bible that God's Word is a summary itself. It's the story of what He is doing with humanity, of His great plan of life for having created us and made us, and what God is doing. But it's this word that tells us why. It tells us the motivation. Now, I said it's a summary of His way of life. Let's look at that, if you will, in Matthew chapter 22. Matthew 22. And we'll begin in verse 34. Matthew 22, 34. When the Pharisees heard that He had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked Him a question, testing Him, saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus said to him, "You want to know the great commandment? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." The word is love. You shall love the Lord your God. That's why it's a summary. It summarizes the way of God. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Everything hangs on that. Everything else is everything else is putting the meat to the bones. It's fleshing it out in more detail of what it means, but fundamentally it's you love God and you love your neighbor. You love your fellow man. Both of which humanity has a serious problem with understanding and being able to do. I said earlier it's a summary of God Himself. Let's go to 1 John chapter 4. 1 John 4. 1 John 4, 8. "He who does not love does not know God." Whoa, that's pretty strong. If you do not love, you don't know God, He said. For God is love. We can say that very easily, but what does that mean? God is love. And in verse 16, He repeats it. "And we have known and believed the love that God has for us. God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him." This is that agape we were talking about last night. There is a level. There's a level of agape on a human level, but then there is a God level of agape. And he's talking about that level of God, of love that is God. These are some pretty strong statements here, aren't they? You see, by the time that the church had been around for 50 or 60 years after it started, the Apostle John had seen a lot of this in action. He had seen a lot of it going on. He had been able to stand back and analyze so many things that had happened in the church and happened in society. And what you find him writing about at the end of his life, inspired by God, had a lot to do with this concept of what love is. He had seen humanity in action. He had seen Christianity in action. He had seen people fall short. He'd seen people rise above the human level. He was an old man when he wrote these three short letters, and God inspired him to write some very strong words. What we read was pretty strong. Notice 1 John 2. I think some of these have been used already this morning, but they are worth repeating. 1 John 2:5. Whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. Much earlier in his life, well, some decades earlier, he'd written his gospel. The gospel of John was written quite a few years after the other three gospels. But nevertheless, John is writing here again and repeating what we have quoted as the theme for this weekend. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. He is saying here, by this we know that we are in him. This is how we know. Whoever keeps his word, it has to do with the love of God being perfected in him. The love of God is perfected. The margin, I don't know if you have a New King James, but in my margin, for is perfected, it says, has been completed. In other words, it implies God is working something in us. God is at work building us. He's creating his character within us. And that love of God is being completed. God is working something in us that's a lifelong process. But keeping his word has to do with the love of God. In chapter 3, in verse 10, we find some other strong words. In this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Basically saying, you want to know the difference between the children of God and children of the devil? Here's how you tell. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. You can practice doing righteous stuff all day long. If you don't have that love for your brother in there, it's not of God. In chapter 4, in verse 7, beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. And that's why he said in verse 8, what we read earlier, if you don't love, you don't know God. That sort of thing ought to weigh pretty heavily on us as we stop and consider, okay, where am I? Where am I on this issue of love for one another? In verse 10, and this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son to be the propitiation for our sins. Again, he's talking about degrees. Now, humans have love, but humans don't have this kind of love. We're talking about a depth, a level of attitude and approach and thought and action that God has that we learn from. And he said, this is love. You want to talk about love? Let me show you love. This is the way God was, that he sent his son to give his life for us. Verse 20. If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, you talk about some strong language, he's a liar. John doesn't pull any punches. He's probably saying, hey, I'm an old man, I'll call it the way it is. What's anybody going to do to me? You say you love God, hate your brother, you're a liar. Well, that's, you know, if anybody says, I love God, but man, we hate these people over here in that country, or we hate that those people of that religion or whatever, and you hate your brother, no, you're a liar. You don't understand. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he hasn't seen? Chapter 5, verse 1. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves him who begot also loves him who is begotten. There we get into this brotherly love aspect. If you're begotten by God, you're also going to love those who are also begotten of God. That means our fellow brethren, whomever God calls. And verse 3, this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. It's an interesting statement about keeping the commandments. I think it was mentioned in the seminar earlier today. One of those commandments that God gave said, God said, this is to be a sign between me and my people. The fourth commandment, keeping the Sabbath. That is a sign. It's only one sign. It's an extremely important sign, keeping the Sabbath. But the theme of this weekend is also a sign, isn't it? John 15, verse 34. Go back to the Gospel of John, John 15. John 15, verse 34. That wouldn't be right, is it? How about John 13? It's easier to pick up when you've missed something when that verse isn't even in the mistaken chapter. John 13, verse 34. A new commandment I give to you. Okay, he made this statement about commandments. If you love God, you'll keep the commandments. We go back here, he said, he's quoting Jesus, who said, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another. Now, wait a minute. Loving one another wasn't new. You can go back to Leviticus 19, verse 18, and it says way back there in the Old Testament, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So what did he mean, a new commandment I give you? He goes on, as I have loved you, that you also love one another. Ah, that's what's new about it. The way Jesus loved people was quite a bit higher than the way humans love people. We love those who, you know, those who we have this reciprocal relationship with. He loved the whole world, that he was willing to give his life for every human being. The way he loved, as I have loved you. We're talking about not a different definition of love, we're talking about a deeper depth of love. Reaching the attitude, the mind of Christ. Then he says, this is the sign, verse 35, by this, loving one another the way God loves us, the way Jesus loved us, the way Christ lived his life, gave his life. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. So from Christ onwards, he says, this is it. This is it. There are doctrinal signs of God's people, things of belief and understanding and following that are identifying signs of the people of God. And there are also behavioral signs. The Sabbath is a doctrinal, a commandment sign, an understanding, a belief, a practice that we keep the Sabbath. But love for one another is the behavior, the way we behave toward one another. That is the behavioral sign. We have to have both of them. Paul made it clear that understanding and accepting a doctrine is only part of the picture. It's part of the picture, it's an important part, but that the real test of a person is their capacity to love. Can we behave the same way God behaves? We can understand that when we look at Paul's writings to a church that had all sorts of problems that were dividing them. He opened the book, this letter, in what we refer to today as chapter 1. He didn't write it with chapters, but at the beginning of his letter, he asked the great question that he will address through the rest of this long letter to this congregation. He asked at the beginning, is Christ divided? And the answer is obviously no, he's not, but we are. Human beings are. And he went on to explain that they were an example of not loving one another in ways that all would know that they were his disciples. Paul actually said, you're behaving like everybody else in the world. You're behaving like carnal people behave. So as you go through this book of Corinthians, he first addresses and explains some of the issues that they were facing that divided them. There were various philosophies. There was immorality going on. They were taking each other to court. There were marriage issues. There was the issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols. There was an issue that some were complaining about Paul himself. There were divisions among them. There was upset about the way some were keeping the Passover. He just goes through chapter by chapter. Okay, let's address this one. Let's address this one. Let's address this one. He keeps going through, and then we come to a point in his letter, though, where he backs away from all of these specific things, and he sort of takes the 10,000-foot view, the big picture of it all. And in 1 Corinthians 13, he explains that whatever you know and whatever you have, that's good, but it's not really the whole picture here of life. He said in 1 Corinthians, in chapter 12, ending that chapter, he was talking about spiritual gifts, and they were divided over some of those things. In verse 31 of chapter 12, he says, but earnestly desire the best gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way. There's something more excellent even than having these gifts. And then he explains in chapter 13, verse 1, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, if I can do all these great things, but I don't have love, I'm just like a little clinging brass bell up here, ding, ling, 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 you know. It's just noise. It's just noise. I'm a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge. Now, who does that? Who understands all mysteries and all knowledge? Paul's saying, even if I did, if I understood everything, and even if I had all faith so that I could remove mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. How many martyrs have given their lives for some kind of personal reward? It's happening around us all the time in the Muslim world, in the radical Islamic terrorists. They give their lives, blow themselves up, and other people thinking that they're doing something great. You know, they're so far off base. You might think, well, if anybody gives their body to be burned, wouldn't that be out of love? No, not necessarily. People are doing it all the time today. And it's an act of hate. There are people who can give all their goods to feed the poor in order to get personal recognition. That doesn't mean they're doing it out of love. And so he's cutting to the chase here to say this is what is really important. So it's very clear when you just touch on a few of those 236 verses. Love is really important. But let's go back to this concept that we started with. What does love look like? What does love look like? Last night in the Bible study, we went through the overview of the meaning of the Greek words used in the New Testament for love. Those are more explaining definitions, and that's very insightful to understand various definitions and how they're used. But when you go beyond definitions, and you say, okay, let's talk about real life in action, everyday life, you and me today, here, tomorrow, next week, What does love look like? In action. What does it look like? If this was a true seminar, if we were giving a seminar today, I might say, okay, let's break out into some breakout groups. I'm going to give you 5 minutes to describe somebody who loves people. What would you come up with? What does love look like? Well, we could come up with probably things that would describe love, some aspects of love very well. Sometimes you might find it easier to describe love by what it isn't. Someone who loves, I suspect we would come up with descriptions like they think and see the best in other people. They have a positive view of people. Maybe some you might say, well, love is, it's somebody who takes a stand for what is right. They love God and they're willing to take a stand for what is right. Love is willing to be inconvenienced. They can deal maturely with the bumps of life. When things come up, they can express their lives that way. They can put up with a lot. They don't get bent out of shape. They don't retaliate. They're positive about life. You might say love is when somebody is very sensitive about the needs of others, but they're very thick-skinned when it comes to things that come against them. And, they can handle the darts of life, and they can handle that in a way that's not self-absorbed. They're not self-absorbed. Love is when somebody is patient and when they're kind. Love is when they're not full of envy. They are gracious. They're not arrogant. They're not egotistical. They are polite. They're not rude. They're not selfish. They're not touchy, irritable, moody. We could come up with all sorts of descriptions of what a person who loves looks like. Would you say those are some good descriptions? I hope so, because I didn't come up with them. God did. I just reworded what Paul writes in the next few verses. You take the next few verses here, verses 4-8, and this is what God inspired. God says, this is what love looks like. Love suffers long. It's kind. Doesn't envy. Love does not parade itself. Is not puffed up. Does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked. How long is your fuse? You have a short fuse in life? It says love has a long fuse. I think in the King James it says it's not easily provoked. Thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. When you read the context of chapter 13 in light of the previous 12 chapters, where Paul was dealing with all these specific issues and problems, what he comes to in chapter 13 is saying, folks, the reason why you're having so many of these problems is because you don't love each other the way God wants you to love. And here's what it looks like. Here's the way we need to be. You members who are suing each other and taking each other to court, it's not love. There's a better way. There's a way to solve your issues that's in a godly manner, not in a manner of human beings. And ultimately, it's out of love for one another that you do it God's way. Those of you who are not considerate of people who get offended at meats offered to idols, here's a way to approach it that's out of love for the person. And you who are too easily offended about people eating meats that have been sacrificed to idols, maybe you ought to have a little bit deeper love toward one another and reconsider the way you're judging them, dealing with them, looking at all of this. This is what God is looking for. These are real life examples of what love is. How many of these things would you say, oh, that makes me feel good. Love is Love just gives me that warm feeling. It is a warm feeling when somebody works that way, but that warm feeling is based on a specific behavior. It does make you feel good when somebody treats you right. When somebody is kind, yeah, that gives you a warm feeling, but love is not a warm feeling. A warm feeling is the result of somebody behaving in the right way, in a loving way. This is what God is looking for. Sometimes, you know, we see these things as standalone issues. And you could say that's true. Parents in here probably try to teach your children, don't be rude, you know, be polite. You can say, I'm going to work on my child on being polite. You teach your child, don't be selfish. You try to reduce it to a level they can understand. Sharing is fun, you know. Share your toys, share this. You might say, well, I'm teaching them to share, or I'm teaching them to be polite. Yes, but in the big bucket of life, you're teaching them to love. You're teaching them, you should be teaching them, be polite, because that's the right way to treat people. It's not the right way to get ahead. It's the right way to treat a fellow human being. All of these things go into that bucket called love. It's a way to treat people, to see people, to appreciate people. And they are issues of character development. All of these things here are issues of character development. Suffering long sometimes takes work. Sometimes it takes more work with certain people, as we heard in one of the seminars. Some people are easier to love than others. Some people are easier to love from a distance. It's just the way it is, isn't it? But it takes work at times to be this way. Now, let me ask you a question. What type of people do you like to be around? What type of people do you like to be around? That you like to have over to the house? What type of people are good for you to have as an acquaintance who make you a better person? What type of people do you like to have as friends? Do you like to have as a friend? Do you like to be around the person who thinks and sees the best in people, or somebody who's always picking out the worst and picking on the negatives? Which person do you like to be around? Do you like to be around or be an acquaintance of somebody who's willing to take a stand for what is right, or somebody who caves in what is wrong and tries to pull you in the wrong direction? Who do you like to be around? Do you like to be around somebody who is willing to be inconvenienced? Somebody who can deal responsibly and maturely with problems? Or would you rather be around somebody who's just whining all the time when nothing goes right? Complaining. Like on the Saturday Night Live skit, Debbie Downer, who's always talking about how bad life is. Would you rather be around with somebody who can put up with a lot, doesn't get easily bent out of shape, who doesn't have a spirit of retaliation against other people? Or would you rather be around somebody who's just quick-tempered and easily riled, easily angered, flies off the handle? Would you rather be around somebody who's positive about life or somebody who's negative about life? Would you rather be around somebody, who do you like better? People who are thin-skinned or people who are not thin-skinned? People who are not self-absorbed, who are easily offended? Would you rather be around, do you like being around people who are patient with your weaknesses and your shortcomings and your mistakes? Or would you rather be friends with somebody who's critical and always quick to jump on you? Would you rather be around somebody who's kind or somebody who's mean? Would you rather be around somebody who is jealous or somebody who's not, doesn't have that green streak of envy? Would you rather be friends with somebody who's arrogant, egotistical, boastful about themselves, or somebody who's humble? You'd rather be friends? You like to be around people who are rude or people who are polite? Selfish or giving and generous. Somebody who's touchy and irritable, or somebody who is peaceful and calm and slow to anger. It's a no-brainer, isn't it? People like to be around. Let's see. Oh, people like to be around these kind of people. People who exhibit these traits of 1 Corinthians 13. I like being around people who behave like this. And this is what love looks like, the Bible says. That's what love looks like. So back to the original question. If Jesus had been born 16 years ago and was a teenager in your school, would the kids like him? Would the teachers? Would the parents? Would the neighbors? When he got his job, summer job at 16, working on the construction crew with his dad's company, would his coworkers have liked him? What did Jesus look like? I don't mean, oh, he's about 5'10", black hair, brown eyes, stocky. I don't mean that. I mean, what did his behavior look like? What did his behavior look like? Again, we don't have any information about his teenage years, but what you see in the Bible of what he was like as a young adult, you ever think about that? When Jesus died, he died at an age that we would still define in the church today as a young adult. What we find in his life as a young adult would not have been any different at 16. He just would have been a little more mature. He'd have had more experience behind him at 30 than he did at 16. But his fundamental character was already there at 16. He was not arrogant. He was not egotistical. He was not rude. He was not selfish. He was not irritable. You see somebody in the biblical account of his life who was caring, he was kind, he was patient, he was compassionate, he was strong, he was convicted, he was positive, he was encouraging, he stood for right, he was moral, he was friendly. He was all of these things that you read here. Would he have been liked? In my opinion, I think he'd have been one of the most liked kids at school. Now, I'm not saying that everybody would have liked everything he did. I'm not saying that everybody would have liked to have run with him and his group. I'm not saying that they would have wanted to do what he did, but would they have liked him? Would they have liked him? Was he an oddball? Was he goofy? Did he hide in his bedroom, memorizing scripture every waking hour? Would he have gone down and shot hoops with everybody? Why not? Wasn't he normal? Wasn't he a normal human being? When he was in his life that the Bible describes, he loved being with people. He was kind to people. When he was with people, did he hang out only with his friends? Was he cliquish? No. You know, he sat down to eat with publicans and sinners. As we saw in that scripture last night, he was later accused of being a friend, and the word is philos, meaning the root of that is love. You're somebody who loves sinners and publicans. And there were some people who roasted him over that. But he did. He sat down and talked with sinners and publicans. He didn't run with them. He didn't do the things they did. He kept his moral high ground. But he would talk to a sinner and a publican. When Jesus was 16 at school today, would he sit down at a lunch table and talk with the girl with purple hair? Or the guy who had the chain running from his nose to his earlobe? Would he talk with them? He would. He came to die for them. I think he'd probably talk to them. Because he was nice to people. He treated people right. Would he run with their crowd? No. Would he go on Saturday night to a rave? No. Can't really see him getting in the mosh pit. But I can't see him shunning any contact with those people. How would he have treated them? Just saying that God is love, and he was God on the earth, and 1 Corinthians 13 is the way he lived. That's the way he was. And people who are like that, people generally like to be around those kind of people. You like to be around people who act this way. Think about it, don't you? Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, there were people who didn't like him. And that's true, especially after he began his ministry. After he began his ministry, he had his enemies. But who were his enemies? Who were the ones who really were his enemies? They were the ones who didn't like him. And one of the main reasons were because other people did like him. The Pharisees got all bent out of shape because, look, he's drawing all these people after him. Why was he drawing people after him? Because he taught them sound, good ways to live. He helped them. He healed them. It says he was moved with compassion when he saw they were hungry, and he fed them. He did good things for them. Now, people didn't always like it when he told them things they had to change. They didn't always agree and say, well, yeah, we're just going to do that. Not everybody liked everything he preached, but most liked him because he was a nice, genuine, loving man. Think about it. How would he have treated the unpopular, introverted kids at school? How would he have treated the introverted? The kids who were poor, the kids who had been abused and maybe had some emotional difficulties, how would he have treated them? Would he have been a bully? Or would he have stood up for the bullied? What would he have acted like? How would he have comforted or made fun of the kids who were insecure? The kids who were too small or too large to fit everybody else's standard of approval? The kids who were easy targets. How would he have dealt with the ones who were fearful or shy or backward? What about the emotionally unstable kids? I think I know how he would have treated the emotionally unstable because I read accounts of how he healed, because of his compassion, kids who were demon-possessed. He felt for them. He felt deeply for them. What about the kids who were uncoordinated, who wanted to play basketball but couldn't dribble it very well, weren't very good? Would he have been an inclusive type of person? Would he have urged them on, encouraged them, been positive about them? What type of guy would he have been? I think of a great example of how he broke all the norms of the day was when he talked at length with a Samaritan woman. In the culture, you didn't talk to a Gentile as a Jew. You didn't talk to a Samaritan. They were, let's see, what were the Samaritans called by the Jews? Dogs. Do you think Jesus ever called somebody a dog? He talked to a woman, and when you read that in John 4, he talked to her with dignity, with respect, held an intelligent conversation with her. And apart from that discussion, sometimes we read John 4 and you read about the things they were talking about, but when you look at how he talked to her. He talked to her as a human being. That was his character, and she marveled at it. She marveled at it, and she went back to the village, and she told everybody about it. And then that village came out to hear him. When you read about the Gospels, you see he commonly healed people. Why? Was it to show off his power? Hey, look what I can do. You know, was it to point to his great ability? No. It was out of compassion. There's a striking example of his heart and his attitude and his approach in Mark chapter 1. In Mark chapter 1, this is shortly after he began his ministry. And there are several things. He's teaching them. He goes into the synagogue and he taught. It astonished people. He taught with authority. And he rebuked an unclean spirit out of a person. And it says his fame spread. And then he heals Peter's mother-in-law. And then it says in verse 32, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city was gathered together at the door. And he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. You might say, well, yeah, do that, and of course people are going to like you. Go around giving free meals and be healed, be healed, be healed. And of course, if I could do that, people would like me too. But I think they sensed something more than just somebody who had the power. There was something when you're around people, sometimes you can pick up on things. Sometimes you can tell where they're coming from. And in verse 40, something really, really marvelous happens. In verse 40, then a leper came to him. A leper. Now let's stop right there. Today this is known as Hansen's disease. It is a disease that's incurable. It can be treated, but in these days and ages, there is nothing more feared than leprosy. It affected the whole body. It usually began with fatigue and pain in the joints. Then you start getting these scaly spots on your skin. And as this disease progresses, your body starts getting covered with pus-filled nodules. Very disturbing to even see. Your face, your appearance gets altered. Somebody with leprosy. The body, it was said, was in a state of living decomposition. And a bad stench develops around people with leprosy. It usually takes years, and somebody who has leprosy died a horrible death. And one of the worst aspects of leprosy is that you were isolated socially. You can even go back to Leviticus 13, verses 45 and 46, and the Levitical law was that somebody with leprosy was put outside the camp because of its contagion. By the time of Christ, the rabbis had added even more laws to it. This is one of those areas they had added to the law governing lepers. Rabbis generally despised lepers because they saw them as people who had a special judgment from God, and they deserved no pity, no mercy. When it was determined that a man had leprosy or a woman, they would banish them from the village. They were not allowed to have communion with other people. What was that movie made years ago? Was it Ben-Hur or The Robe? One of those movies that showed a leper in it and how it was. You left your family. You left your friends. You were in isolation. It was unlawful for a leper to approach within about 50 feet of somebody. You couldn't touch anybody. You couldn't touch your family. You could only see them from a distance. Whenever a leper went out, they had to cry, unclean, unclean, to warn people. A lot of people would throw rocks at them to keep them at a distance. It's quite a story when it says a leper came to him. This man had to be pretty brave, number one, because he was going outside the bounds of normal protocol. And Jesus didn't throw any rocks at him. Jesus didn't say anything about him. He knelt down. He came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him and saying to him, if you are willing, you can make me clean. This man exhibiting faith, He didn't question whether God had the ability or not. He just said, hey, if it's your will, it can be done. Great faith. And Jesus moved with compassion. Notice, put out his hand and touched him. Put out his hand and touched him. He was moved with compassion. Compassion refers to a feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another who is stricken with some misfortune, and it is accompanied by a strong desire to do something about it. It's not that you just feel sorry. You're going to do whatever you can to do something. And the first thing he did was he put out his hand and touched him. He did not have to do that to heal him. You don't have to touch somebody. He could have healed him with his word because he had done that already. But he healed a leper with a touch. He touched him. You know, it had probably been years since any other human being had touched this man. Think about what it's like to live life without being touched by anybody. When nobody wants to be near you. What would that be like? What does that do to you psychologically when you can't even be touched? You see everybody else in here giving hugs to one another and nobody will come near you. What is that like? It had been years since he had held his wife or his children probably. He'd been isolated. I wonder what this man thought when Jesus did more than just say, I'll heal you, but when Jesus reached out and touched him. What did that feel like? To that man. What was it like for Jesus not to say, hey, stand back, just tell me what you want from back at the door there, would you? I'll send you an anointed cloth. He reached out and he touched him. What do you think other people thought when they saw that? When the people, everybody else who's watching this, what did they think when they saw that? You see, I don't think they thought, wow, look at all his power. I think they had to think, look at his compassion. Look at the way he is. Look at his love for that person to be able to do that. As you read the Gospels, look at Jesus' life through the lens of the expressions of love. When you do, you discover that love is not just an emotional feeling. It's a way of behaving. It's a way of behavior for people. And reaching the love, that level of love that God has, is a lifelong quest for his people. And it's based, as I was explaining last night, on a choice. On a choice to be like him. To strive to be the way he is. To do things that aren't natural for a human being to want to do toward other people. As I was saying last night, to love one's enemies is not natural. It's hard. It requires work. It requires a conviction of the will to say, this is what I need to be like. This is what I'm going to start working on to be like, to reach that point. We don't do that overnight. It takes growth. It takes change. But at the end of the day, who do you want to be around? Who do you want to be like? Who would you like to be around? Let me ask you this. Who do you want to look like? Who do you want to look like? In 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 1, following up chapter 13, it says, pursue love. That word means go after it, cultivate it. Think about it, pray for it, because it has to be with God's help, but it's got to be pursued because it doesn't just come naturally. It comes through God's Spirit, and as we do, God will change our lives. God will change lives. Christ reached out and touched a leper. God will touch your life too through a healing that helps us get beyond some of our problems that we have as human beings with love. And we all have them. I told a story at the feast, and I'll repeat it here. Some years ago, Dee and I were in another country, which I'll leave nameless. We were there for the Passover in the days of unleavened bread. I was conducting the Passover, and during the foot washing, you know, you get up. I didn't know anybody there, basically, you know, to speak of. I'd never been to that country, met people for the first time, some of them, before the Passover. Comes time for the foot washing, you get up, you go out, and you just line up with whoever is next to you. And I was next to this middle-aged black man that I'd never met before. We washed one another's feet, as usual, and proceeded on with the service. 2 days later, after the services on the holy day, he came up to me and he said, I need to tell you something. I said, okay. He said, I was healed at the Passover. I said, what do you mean you were healed at the Passover? And he said, ever since I came in the church, he said, my biggest struggle as a Christian has been hating white people. He said, I suffered a lot in my youth at the hands of some white people. And he told me later some of the things, and it was true suffering. And he said, even though I've known it was wrong, I have really struggled not to be extremely prejudiced against them. And it's been a hard struggle. But he said, at the foot washing, I was sitting in my chair and I was looking down and watching you, a white man, wash my feet. And he said, I just felt those feelings of hatred and prejudice that I've carried for years. He said, I just felt them drain away. They just drained away. He said, I left with peace and I know God has healed me. That was moving. Never had that happen. He was on his way to learning how to love and how to be loved. I take no credit for it. I didn't even know what was going on. I've had 40-something Passovers, and each one is meaningful, but I had no concept of what God was doing in the mind of a person right next to me. No concept at all. But I believe God was working in that man to make that possible. God was helping him to overcome his struggle and reach a higher level and capacity to understand and implement love. And in order for him to love other people, he had to get past that barrier that was blocking that. And God simply used that opportunity in a way that he didn't expect when he went there that night, and I didn't expect. If he hadn't told me, I still wouldn't know about it. But God used that to teach and to help. God's way teaches us. We go to the Passover and we learn about the love of God. And we engage in that symbolic act of foot washing. We often talk about, well, foot washing, that's learning about serving. But isn't learning about serving learning about love? Isn't that what is the basis of service as well? Pure service. And then in our process of growing, we get these breakthroughs like this man got. That all comes from the love of God. It comes through the working of God's Spirit. And through that, we grow and we change and we learn to love better the way that God loves. We don't get it all at once. It takes time. It takes effort. You look around the world today, and you see so many people hurting over things that are going on, hurting over the way they've been treated, hurting over the consequences of sin that have scarred them. You see people who sincerely want peace. They want to see an end to the strife, and many who would do in their mind anything they could to achieve it, but human efforts are just so stinking limited. What we can do on our own is just so limited. It's because we pick some good off the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but then we pick evil off the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and they don't mix well. And we just don't get to where we need to get. The ends thereof are the ways of death. Everybody talks about love, but we're just not so good getting there, are we? We're just not there. That's why it's godly love that breaks down the barriers between God and man, and then between man and man. And that's what we're shooting for. I guess I'm convinced that we have a lot to learn about love. We have a lot to grow in. But I'm also convinced we're in the process. We're in a process. I'm also convinced the more I see and experience in this life that Jesus was absolutely correct. By this will all men know if you're my disciples. If you can get there, if you can get to love, that's when you see the work of God in somebody. And I'm convinced that now is the time to be preparing our hearts this way. One of the most powerful things God or Jesus Christ said about the signs of the end of the age is that because iniquity will abound, the love of many will grow cold. It's going to happen. Love is our self-defense spiritually. Love of God is our protection in that world. That's why we really need to understand this and focus on it. 2 Timothy 3:1-5, you can turn there and read it. It's the 19 signs of the times of stress, the perils at the end of the age. Look at those 19 things that are listed, and you will see every single one of them have to do with a lack of love. Every one of them. This lack of love shows itself in certain types of behavior. 1 Corinthians 13 tells you what love looks like. 2 Corinthians 3 tells you what a lack of love looks like. And this is what we're going to be up against. So becoming like Christ, growing to love like God, is essential for our spiritual survival. It is our spiritual self-defense. And that's why we need to be on a lifelong quest to grow in that love of God. It's a great exam. It's a great way to examine ourselves regularly to see where we are in that process. It's a growth thing. Don't be discouraged if you look at it and say, well, I'm not there. None of us are there, but we can be growing that way. Let me illustrate it this way. Sorry for those of you on the webcast. I might step out of the picture. But if it was a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 would be somebody who just seemingly has no love for anybody. Let's take that Las Vegas shooter who seemed to be at a point in life where all he wanted to do was just kill people. That doesn't seem to be a shred of love in his life. If he's at one end of the scale and Jesus Christ is at the other, and I say, why don't you come up on stage and stand where you think you are? On this scale of 1 to 10, where are you? Well, nobody's going to be down here with that guy. I don't think anybody's going to come up here. Well, Jesus, it's just you and me have this kind of love. Where would you be on the scale of no love to the love of God? If you came up here and said, well, maybe where would you place yourself on the scale of moving from no love to the perfecting love of God? Where would other people put you on the scale? You came up here and said, well, I think I'm about here. Everybody said, where would they put us? The really important thing is, where does God put us? Where does God say you are? But even more important than that, where were you a few years ago compared to now? And where will you be a few years from now? The thing of it is, growing to be like Christ, growing to be like God, is a process of movement. And it's our whole life. We've got to be moving that direction, growing. You want to pick things to grow in? Start with 1 Corinthians 13. It's real practical stuff. It's very practical, But that's what love looks like. That's what love looks like. And that's where we need to be. I know I've got work to do. You've got work to do. Let's be working together to start on these practical aspects of implementing godly love. That's what love looks like. It's what Christ looks like. Let's make sure we look like love.